from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 281, recorded live Thursday, August 25th, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Jeremy Kratz about the design process.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm sitting down with designer Jeremy Kratz. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the work that he's done for me on the recent site design and some of the things that he's been teaching me about design, as well as learning about mobile and doing progressive enhancement. Thanks a lot for taking the time, Jeremy.
Hey, thanks, Scott, for having me.
So when I called you and you do design work and I said I want a quote, how does that usually work? I know that, I mean, I'm a little more technical than maybe the average person that would call you and ask for a quote. Do people call and they describe emotions, or do people call and give you a picture and say, make it look and feel like this, or do they micromanage, or do they paint a picture? How do you start that interaction when a designer starts working first with a new client?
Well, typically what I like to do is I like to schedule a time where I can either have a call with them or, better yet, even sit down with them in person and kind of get their thoughts as to what they want their site to do. Sometimes they'll explain that with emotional words. Sometimes they'll just have other sites that they've seen that they like the style of, and they'll send me those. It really depends on the client and exactly how much thought they may have put into it ahead of time, based on whether or not they have a site already and some changes they like to see, or if they're just starting from scratch. So it really kind of depends on who I'm talking to as to how much information they give me up front.
Are there certain kind of people that you know are going to be a problem, just even in the initial interaction, that you say, oh, this guy's going to be high maintenance and he's going to tell me down to the pixel what he wants?
Sometimes it is very easy to see that, especially if they have, you know, just one site and bad keywords in my mind are, I want it to look exactly like this, or, you know, I want it to be the Facebook of something. So usually if they have a very specific design in mind, it's kind of hard to convince them that maybe they don't want a site that looks exactly like someone else's.
Do they give you inspiration? I know that when people are designing rooms and designing, you know, doing interior design, they'll bring in like color swatches and things like that.
Yes, yeah, some people do provide color swatches, and that's always great because that gives me an idea as to kind of the style, the aesthetic that they like. So I do appreciate having those points to jump off on.
With my site, I was looking for organic, light, fresh. What were some of the things that I said to get you started? Because I want to understand what that process was like for you and
sure,
when you knew you had it.
You mentioned, you know, organic, fresh, natural kind of earth tones as far as colors go. That made me kind of think, you know, you're wanting to have a personal connection to the visitors on your site. You don't want something that's cold, something that's very corporate. So I kind of took those colors and kind of experimented, and I thought one of the ways that we could try to accomplish that was also kind of through the typography of your main title, so your new logo that came with the site. I tried to find a font that was professional, but had a little bit of personality with it. And then you'll notice that each line is kind of a different style of the same font at different sizes and different weights, and it kind of mixes it up a little bit, gives it a little bit of variety so that it's not quite as stuffy.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the things that I found was that people will not tell you how bad your site was until you get it redesigned, and then they're like, oh man, you had a problem. That was awful.
Yeah, people are very honest on the internet, and especially when it comes to a new look for something that they're very familiar with. So they will definitely not hold back when something changes.
Yeah, I think I was taking a chance because, of course, people don't like you to move their cheese. What was the issue with there was a group called Gawker that did a number of websites and they went through a recent redesign. I'm sure that was big in the design community. What happened there?
That was definitely huge. That was I think what happened is that they saw the tablet market really shoot up, and I think that's kind of their goal was to focus on that because a lot of their redesign was focused on interactions with JavaScript, so that all the scrolling was not necessarily handled natively by the browser, but they used a built-in scroll, and I think that was the main issue that people had was that the site didn't behave like a typical blog would. They were trying to manipulate the way that the site worked to fit on a tablet device, and maybe people typically expect, when they scroll to get a natural scroll from the web browser. So I think their redesign, they approached it more from a specific device's functionality, and maybe their audience wasn't really on board with that.
So there's when you redesign a site, there's the design, the fonts, the look, the white space, the way the things line up, and then there's the interaction design. The Gawker sites aren't necessarily ugly, so it's the interaction design that they failed on, the interaction model, the user experience.
Exactly. And if you look at something like Google, does several progressive enhancements to their sites constantly. They made a really big one for them a few weeks ago when they launched Google Plus. The title links across the very top of the browser, they changed that from like a white background to a really dark gray. They don't necessarily change the way the site functions as much as they continually try to freshen it up, try to improve the user interface, but they're not actually changing the way users interact with the content so often. So from that viewpoint, I think their users are more accepted to change because it's slower and it's not as jarring. But when something like Gawker happens, when you just load the site one day and it is completely different, then people are just completely lost and they're more prone to abandon the site or try to find another way to get the content.
Exactly. Now back to my site. When you started designing, some of the things that were constraints were that I wanted to use my existing blog engine. I had actually been putting off doing this redesign because I'd always thought that the only blog engine that was going to give me the flexibility to do a new and fresh, good looking, modern looking site was going to be like a WordPress or one of the new ASP.NET blogs. I'm using DOSBlog, and DOSBlog is based on ASP.NET 1. We've upgraded it, since to 3.5, but it's got some old thinking, and it's less about the technology and more about, just older thinking about how stuff works. It had mobile browser sniffing that I had put in 2006. So it was actually swapping out the markup for mobile. It has some hard-coded tables, some interesting use of inline styles. When I had come to you and said, I want to redesign the site, but you have to use this existing templating engine. How often does a constraint like that come along, and does it really oppress you, or do you not sweat it when creating a new design?
I actually kind of enjoy when someone comes to me and says, we have an existing system, we want to use the existing system, we don't want to rethink the way everything works, we would just like to kind of reorganize the UI. I kind of like those constraints to fit in, because then the project's not quite so broad. I can focus on making the interaction with the system better than trying to rethink of how a system would be built from the ground up. So when you came to me and said, I'm using DOSBlog, I had never actually worked with DOSBlog before, but I installed it, downloaded it, and then the first thing I did was stripped out the theme completely just to see what the raw markup looked like. And luckily, there is a lot of flexibility. There was a lot of flexibility in the templates. So it was pretty easy to apply the styles that we needed with CSS and to give it some new flexibility. I think it worked great, and I think that it's going to continue to work great for as long as you need that particular platform.
So let's walk through the process here together, because I think what's significant in what you just said was that you stripped everything out first. So you installed DOSBlog. I gave you a couple of weeks worth of my content, so that you were basically running a local version of my site which meant that you could change the templates and work, you know, kind of interactively right there on your local machine. You stripped everything out. So you made like a, just a white background, black text. And did you apply reset style sheets, or, you know, what did you do to clear the palette?
Sure. What I typically do in a project, like I said, is strip it out, get rid of any existing styles. I always use Eric Myers, CSS Reset, which is a great tool. It just makes sure that, you know, margins and paddings, they're all consistently, reset. And then I just kind of went from there. I spent a few days, trying to sketch out ideas, for, you know, how I want your header to look, how I'd want the sidebar to look, but I kind of ran into a dead end. So what I started doing, what I typically try to do in situations like that is to kind of step back, and plan a little better. So what I did in that case for you, is I looked at your old site and I wrote down, you know, every link that you had in the header, every section that you had in your sidebar and in your footer. So I tried to kind of focus on, what information you had already and how I might be able to better organize that. So then from there, I just kind of started trying to group things, draw some boxes around areas, try to figure out how everything should be categorized. One of the issues that you brought up in our initial conversation was that maybe when new visitors come to the site, they don't immediately understand what it is you do, and what all the content you have available on your site is. So to address that, I just tried to kind of group your main navigation into the top areas that you focus on. So we came up with, you know, the about or the info section, and then we had your list of podcasts and your speaking and your books. And then from there, it just really naturally, evolved into that top navigation. And then putting in the search functionality below that just really finished it out and made it line up with the logo. And then from there, luckily it was a pretty standard, blog design with a main column bar and then a sidebar. And it just really kind of took off from there. So there was that one moment where it just kind of clicked. And in your case, that was with your main navigation.
Yeah. And I've actually had interesting feedback. I've had a couple of friends call and say they didn't like the top navigation. They said that they prefer these kind of new style WordPress sites where you show up and they use a lot of vertical space and they have, you know, big evocative photography or a giant picture of yourself. And there are many, many really cool blogs that have a very minimal style. You know, the only bit of even remotely negative feedback I've had on the site was that, wow, there's a lot of links. But I just can't get myself to let go of the fact that if I show up on a blog and it's a white background and black text and it's just like the latest article, there's no sense of scope. There's no sense of depth. There's no, I don't know if this person's been here blogging for 10 years or if they just showed up last week. So sure. It was important to me to show a sense of depth to the, you know, to the site.
And I agree. And in your case, you write about a lot of technical subjects. You've got lots of diagrams. You have lots of figures that you reference in your posts. And I feel like the minimal style works well, maybe more for non-technical posts, without a lot of diagrams. So, you know, I think that the solution that we ended up with works well for your audience and for the message you're trying to get across.
One of the things that we started getting into also was fitting all of this onto the screen. For example, I wanted it to look good on an iPad. We actually didn't talk about mobile until later. We had it as a goal, but I'm on a 30-inch monitor, but I did some research, and I actually have blogged about this to find out who's on my site. You know, there's enough people at 1280 or 1024 resolution that I wanted things to be flexible. When you were sketching out your design, how do you make a design that is going to work on a 30-inch monitor and is going to work on a 400-pixel-wide phone?
Well, luckily, it was really good timing. I just finished a book called Responsive Web Design by Ethan Marcotte. And he, in his book, steps through the process of designing for those three different areas. So you can do more than three, but three is the typical example. You've got your widescreen, and you've got your tablet, and then you've got your phone device. And really, I think the first step that we tried to do was the tablet size device, and that was as simple as just removing the sidebar and making that main content fill the entire screen. And then from there, it was really just kind of retweaking the way the top menu worked to work on phone size devices, because there just simply isn't enough screen real estate. So for your site, I really approached it first from that widescreen perspective of here's all the information. And then we thought about what can we remove as users' screen sizes scale down.
Someone had commented on Twitter a while back, though, that sometimes people do the opposite. They start with a mobile site and then they add things. So, for example, this particular design, while only 8% of people who visit my blog use mobile devices, which I think is, you know, it's reasonable that it's nice that we're catering to those people, they are going to have to download some of that, aren't they? I mean, if something is set to display none, are my video images and thumbnails going to show up and be downloaded? Or if they're not shown, are they spending their mobile bandwidth on that?
Technically, I don't believe like your images or your video will actually be downloaded unless it's displayed. I might very well be wrong about that, but I don't believe that's the case. But that being said, there is a really strong movement for doing a mobile-first design, just to make sure that at the very lowest level, your site is very well thought out, and that you're expecting user experiences, you know, from the phone, tablet, and large screen on. So that's kind of an approach where you want to start small, so that you can plan at every step up. So it's definitely a valid approach.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools in the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, TeamPulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying Agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself, get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/TeamPulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us.
As a designer who is probably getting quotes to do mobile sites and talking to people who are interested in mobile, are you thinking that you're going to switch from our site's really progressive degradement or degrading rather than it is progressive enhancement. But do you think that you'll switch and go to a mobile-only way to do things? Is it mobile that significant, do you think?
I think it's definitely that significant. The next site that I do, I would love to try the mobile-first approach and just kind of see how that works with my workflow. But from here on out, I really don't see very much of a reason to ever do a site that is not scalable on all devices. I think that's definitely the way to go.
How much time did you spend when you did your design? You sketched it out, and you said that you then switched in to a plain DOS blog. Did you do other versions you didn't show me? I want to understand, like, did this progress, or once you found it and you kind of found the voice that you just kind of ran with it?
Well, like I said, I had an idea in my head when I first started sketching. I kind of mocked that up a little bit in Photoshop, but I just couldn't make it work very well. So I didn't move from Photoshop into actual HTML and CSS at that point. It was only after I kind of grouped everything together, came up with the idea for the main navigation, that I actually started implementing that in the DOS blog engine. And then from there, it's just kind of the one thing that I stuck with. I kept tweaking what I already had on that layout, and it just kind of grew from there, and it seemed to be the correct way to approach it.
I talked a little bit about how developers don't do a very good job of designing, and honestly, the reason that I came to you and came said I need to go out there and pay a designer to do this is that I just am not a designer. It sounds like an obvious statement, but I thought I could do this. I said to myself, you know, I may not be a designer, but, you know, I can lay things out and make them look pretty decent. But it just never quite looked right. And then I noticed a comment in the initial blog post when I said, here's the new design. And it was a compliment from another designer who was saying that it was more than just a background image or a header. They said that it was consistency of white space. It was lines. It was, he used a bunch of designer language that basically said that there was theory behind visual hierarchy, alignment, consistency, balance, appropriate white space, color choices. Are these all principles that you learn in some school, or are these things that you come built in with that I don't have?
I think a lot of it you definitely can learn. I think a good art school, a good graphic design program will teach you the fundamentals of alignment and spacing and the very basics. But then I think designers have to develop their own sense of style. So just because everything on your page is properly aligned and properly spaced doesn't mean that there's not something else, some step that you can take further that's not necessarily written down anywhere in a book. And I think a lot of that has to do with the type of emotion that you're trying to get across. So yes, you can learn a vast majority of it, but I think there's always that personalization that really makes everything come together, makes the design more than just a series of rules that you've tried to follow. It makes it, I guess you'd say, more than the sum of its parts. The whole design, just there's always something that you can add to it to kind of take it a little bit further.
Mm-hmm. Do you do this stuff in Photoshop? Because you said that you went to a pencil first. You were designing and sketching. But then did you mock that? Because I know that there are those designers that basically do everything in Photoshop because it releases them from any constraints. But then I've also heard some designers do all their work in CSS directly so that they don't design themselves into a corner.
Sure. I actually start, you know, with a legal pad or just a notebook, and I try to sketch out the very basic UI. When I have an idea in my mind of where I want to go next, then I'll typically go into Photoshop and do a quick mock-up. But I try to get into the browser as quickly as I can, just so that I know that it's going to look exactly like it will look at the end. So a lot of times I've gone down the road of working in Photoshop for several hours, setting everything correctly, and then there's always something that's just slightly off. The anti-aliasing on the fonts in Photoshop isn't exactly as it is, you know, in Windows or on a Mac. It's not quite the same. And sometimes a small change like that can really affect the direction that you go down. So I always try to jump into the browser and start coding as soon as I have a general idea of where I want to go.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of little tiny things that you've done on the blog that surprised me. The little tiny things, like, for example, I had mentioned that I wanted it to be personal, to connect with the audience. So when you have the comments box at the below each title, you have like a little tiny arrow as if it's a comic book balloon, as if it's coming out of, you know, coming out of our mouths. My latest tweet that is over on the About Scott section also has that little triangle, kind of an evocative arrow that's implying that this box is being spoken by this person. Those seem like the kinds of things that I would design in Photoshop or on pencil and then give up because these are probably like 8x8 pixels. It's so subtle. It's so small. I honestly wouldn't even know where to start to create something like that. How did you do that?
Well, you had, like you said, you had specifically mentioned that maybe comments, the comments link was kind of getting lost. So the first thing I did was, you know, make a box, for the comments and give it a really bold color. And it was just a one-off kind of glance. I noticed that, you know, if I put a tail on this, then it'll, you know, it'll look like a word bubble and that works well with your comments. So, you know, then jumped into Photoshop, made the little arrow graphic, and applied it. And then later on, when we integrated the Twitter feed, I just tried to repeat what I had done in the main bar to give it some consistency. And that's, you know, one of those tenets of graphic design is that anytime that you can repeat an element, you're going to make it stronger. Or the design as a whole will be stronger. So I just used the exact same graphic, added an outline around it, flipped it over, and then moved it over into the sidebar. So it really wasn't planned from the start. It was just one of those things that cropped up along as I was working that I thought would be a good idea to try, and it kind of stuck.
Yeah, it looks like you did it with just as a background graphic, basically a CSS rule that said this element should have a background graphic that's located kind of roughly in this area.
That's right. It's just a little trick where the graphic is actually a white bar, and then the tail is just a knockout of transparent pixels in that shape, and then the rule that we apply in CSS is just to put that background image at the very bottom of whatever container you're in, and then whatever background color that container has, that little arrow will show through. So it's just a mask image. And that gives you the flexibility of changing that comments color, for example, to anything you want, and it'll always work with the word bubble arrow.
See, that's really interesting because there's two things there that are interesting. First, it's a clever design, it's a clever element, but you didn't just make an orange triangle, which is totally what I would do. You made a transparent mask, basically. I mean, just the fact that you said I could change the color later is really interesting, because in the other element, the navigation bar, when we came up with a way for it to work on a mobile browser, basically if you resize the page small enough and you squish that top navigation, it'll collapse into a drop down, which is more appropriate for a mobile. You didn't just hard code the menu again in a drop down. You had a little bit of JavaScript that would literally take that menu and chop it up. So then, a couple days ago, when I updated the menu, I did not have to go and update that. So there's some clever, not repeating yourself kind of techniques in the design as well. That I don't know if that's you being a really good designer, or you being a clever coder. I don't think I would have done that. I would have probably made a little orange triangle, and I probably would have doubled up and created the menu an entire second time. So good on you for doing that.
Oh, thanks. I think that's one of the things you get from doing web design for a while is that you're always trying to be as flexible as possible. So, you know, using CSS is great because we can just have these rules that you know can adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And any time that you know I use a color or that I use a graphic, I always think, you know, what if the client is going to want to change this later? What's going to be A, less work on me, and B, less work on them? And that's the solution we want to go with. So yeah, absolutely. Always try to keep those things in mind.
So kind of walking more through the process, you moved into the browser as quickly as possible. You started laying out elements from your sketches and your Photoshops. You chopped up graphics, and there's actually surprisingly few graphics in this particular thing. There's a couple of lines. There's a couple of triangles. There's the logo. There's very little here. It's mostly text, which if I remember correctly, that was also one of our design tenets, was it to be a typography-friendly template as opposed to an image-heavy template.
That's right, yeah. So I always try to use as few images as possible. I always like for the browser to do the heavy lifting. So, you know, if I have a border, I'll always try to use the browser border CSS property instead of, you know, designing a border, a fancier border in Photoshop, and then trying to pull that in. So I always try to make my markup as small as possible, and then my CSS as small as possible, and to use as few images as I possibly can. And that's just from an effort to make things more flexible, to make things load faster, and to make maintenance as low as possible.
Mm-hmm. And I've been trying it on a bunch of different browsers, and I'm finding that it looks surprisingly good on browsers I never even thought about. Like, this works in IE7. I don't even think you went out of your way to make it look good on IE7. Is that as a result of the reset CSS that you used from Eric Meyer, or is that as a result of you avoiding certain CSS tricks that you know were you know, were edgy, for lack of a better word.
Definitely a combination of both. So the CSS reset definitely makes sure that, you know, all the line heights and the margins and the padding are consistent on all browsers. But then I try to, through a few years of experience, I know certain CSS styles to kind of avoid, because I know that they may be problematic in older versions of IE, older versions of other browsers. So I have a few that I just kind of stick with when I want to accomplish something, and they typically manage to scale down pretty well as far as going back to previous versions. So that's just kind of a goal that I always have in mind, is to not necessarily do something that may not adapt properly to older browsers.
Yeah, it's been impressive. Actually, the things that aren't working are some of my older things, like my code blocks. I think we talked a little about that. I had to put in a bit of a hack to force my code blocks, which use a thing called syntax highlighter that converts pre's into syntax highlighted code. Looks a little bit weird on iPhones and iPads. It ends up basically they take the pre, they parse the code, they color it, and they squish it back in as a bunch of tables and stuff. Looks great on a desktop, looks consistent on the desktop, looks weird remotely. So there's little islands where you can actually kind of see Scott through Jeremy, if you know what I'm saying. Like the site's clean, and then you go and hit an old post with some foolish inline font that I threw in, and you go, oh, okay, there's Scott.
You can't necessarily account for anything, especially when users are generating the content. So you just kind of have to, you know, do your best, and then if things like that crop up, then, you know, no big deal.
And then one of the things that we talked about on the blog was hiring a designer. People have said sometimes that famous bloggers or quote unquote big bloggers will put out a call and say, hey, redesign my blog for free and I'll give you free advertising. And a lot of design, that used to be a popular thing in the 90s and the early 2000s, and a lot of people pushed back on that, and they said that devalues design as a concept, like, really, will design for food is somehow appropriate. What do you feel about that kind of thing?
Oh, I absolutely agree with the whole no speculative work movement. That being said, unfortunately, you go to my site and you'll notice that I've participated in those earlier in my career. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's something that I don't necessarily want to do going forward. I think it's typically a bad idea for a company that actually can hire a designer. So they mm-hmm. have the capability of doing it, but they just maybe don't see the value in doing that if they can try to get it for free. Some design contests, you know, by nonprofit companies that have a good goal and maybe don't have the funding, that may be a route they want to go down. But I don't agree with someone trying to get speculative work just because they either don't see the value in it or they don't want to spend the money. So I would say generally I'm definitely opposed to it. But there are certain cases where, you know, that might be appropriate for a company to do.
Mm-hmm. And kind of in conclusion, what do you say to people who are looking to engage with a designer about, who may not necessarily agree that there's value there? I mean, how do you sell your value proposition? Because I admit I'm the first guy who went and tried to do this kind of work myself, and I am sold. I mean, I will engage a designer earlier in projects now and early and often.
Well, I think it's kind of convincing someone that there is that element that they may miss out on unless they hire someone to do it who has experience doing it and who does it for a living. Like you said, you could spend all day you know, writing CSS or designing a site, but you may not be happy with the end result. And I think really when someone has a site, they have a product that they want to take that extra step, and they haven't worked with a designer to improve it, I think they'll instantly see the value if they get a professional to work on it. So it's really kind of, you know, convincing them that that there are improvements to be had outside of just these technical areas of you know, writing CSS and laying out the HTML. That there is that element that can always enhance whatever it is they have.
Definitely, definitely. I am sold. You don't need to convince me anymore. Hopefully we'll convince some listeners, though, because I've enjoyed talking to you. I've talked to Jin Yang, and I think coincidentally, you designed one of the initial layouts for Stack Overflow, and then now Jin Yang works at Stack Overflow as well, and both of you now have been on the podcast. We should have more designers on the show.
Absolutely. We'll be glad to come in.
Cool. Well, you can check out Jeremy at jeremykratz.com and check out his portfolio of work. And you can also see his work on hanselman.com. This has been another episode. We'll see you again next week.